to our October Ethics Commission meeting. Meeting call to order at 9:40 a.m. Let's get to it. So let's go to the approval of the minutes. Have all the commissioners had a chance to peruse the minutes? If there are any questions or comments, is there a motion to approve the minutes?
I move to approve the minutes.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. We have, I'm sorry, item number two, Mr. Previn. I'm sorry.
I think what it is there's a community impact statement that we had submitted, which is item three. I'm happy to talk on the minutes. Did I said submit number two? Because I do have
you
a comment.
Did.
Okay, so the
and
comment
you,
on the minutes.
And you're also on number three.
Fair enough. I just wanted to briefly comment on the minutes. I was looking at the Q1, Q2 lobbying summaries, which are very, very good. And I looked back on the June minutes, because that's the last meeting you had, I guess, or maybe August. But the point is that it was mislabeled, the lobbying summary. It was labeled as Q1 18, but it's actually 19. So if they want to fix that, because it sent me around in circles for about 10 minutes, but I finally got to the bottom of it. So thank you for that. And I'm sorry I missed the last meeting. And if I could just roll into my brief comments and then be gone, is that possible? Or
sure.
Yeah, I'll just. So the 12-1269 S5 issue has to do with the matching funds. And since there's a new election cycle starting, I want to give a little update on how that's been going. You remember there was a $25,000 threshold to be admitted to the program. They lowered it subsequent to Mr. Bonin's initiative down to 11,400 or something like that. So now local city council candidates, for example, are trying to get just $114 times 100 would give them what they need if they're all in the district. But there's a way to make that even easier if you just get, you know, $5 from 100 people in the district, and then you can reach out to the moneyed set from around Brentwood and other places. But nonetheless, it makes it substantially easier, I guess, but still completely impossible, I just want to disclose right now, for a candidate like Eric Previn. I mean, it's just going to be very hard to do that against an incumbent. So I think they did a very nice job of finding the right balance to completely block, you know, organic candidates from really good. But on the other hand, let's see what happens, you know. To report back on the CD12 dynamic, you know, John Lee and Lundquist got the max, almost, and a bunch of other candidates, but not too many, just a handful, got some matching money. So, you know, I don't know if it's a great success or not, but what is not a great success is the fact that that special election has rolled right into a regular election. So now we are having, as I was pointing out, at the urging of Waste Management and Greg Smith and Herb Wesson, the second expensive election in CD12, which just seems absurd, because we just had a big election. And, you know, when we looked at Section 409 of the Charter, you can see that there was no actual requirement to have two, but the council president, who is one of the great beneficiaries of this scam, felt that it was appropriate. So that's why we're doing it. But that's that. Moving on to the Pellico matter, very briefly, if I may, I just wanted to say that I agree that individuals should be held accountable, not just companies. It feels very strange that they're moving around. And by the way, their scam of laundering didn't sound that hard to understand. I mean, a big boss said, if you donate, I'll reimburse you. But that's laundering. And yet at NBC Universal, where David Rue raised, you know, comparable, even more money from people who list that they work for NBC Universal, and the big guy gave, you know, we don't know if they're getting reimbursed, if part of their executive package is to get. So I find these rules, it's good that we caught someone for something, and they happen to be super rich and have a $59 million house, so the $71,000 penalty, good job, Cohen, is not going to make a difference for those guys. You know, I don't particularly think we're looking in the right place, because lobbyists, I was looking at, as I mentioned, Mr. Lowe's, and I'll speeding to the end of my comments here. You know, in the lobbying department, we have to remember that lobbyists are strictly forbidden from giving money, but they're not strictly forbidden from collecting little Easter eggs at their clients, putting them in a basket, and bringing them over to the candidate, and then smiling. So this obviously is a great bit of legal writing that completely undercuts our whole effort to block, you know, outsized influence, in my opinion. We also have the great loophole that I love mentioning around this time of year, which is the wives and spouses and husbands of, you know, lobbyists. They are among the most prodigious donors in the city of Los Angeles. You can see it, Linda Berghoff, Brianna Kanabi, and the list goes on, Donna Black. I just think it's a great opportunity to let, you know, a city council member know that you are behind them without actually having to break the law, because you have your wife, who's perfectly legal, take care of the business. So, you know, with that, I would just say that in Q2 2019, they moved around about $289,000 in fundraising from those folks. You know, Krikorian, who I may run against or am running against, $38,000, you know, in money just delivered by lobbyists. They don't have to do anything. The lobbyists have the fundraisers. The people give the money, and it's all perfectly legal. So I would just say, keep up the good work, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Previn. Now we're moving on to the action items. Item number four, Mr. Platel, please.
Richard Platel, Director of Enforcement, appearing for the Los Angeles City Ethics Commission. Good morning, President Murray. Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
Seated beside me is Stephen Cullen, an investigator in our office.
Can you speak up
a little bit? Yeah.
Thank you.
Seated beside me is Stephen Cullen, an investigator from our office. The stipulation before you for your consideration involves three respondents: Pacific Crest Consulting, Pacific Crest's owner and chief executive officer, Chris Parker, and Pacific Crest's owner and director of planning, John Parker. The three respondents are not represented by counsel and are not present today. Pacific Crest Consulting and Chris Parker both stipulated to 9 counts in violation of the municipal lobbying ordinance for failing to register and failing to file disclosure reports for their city lobbying activities from the second quarter of 2017 through the fourth quarter of 2018. John Parker admits to 8 counts in violation of the municipal lobbying ordinance by failing to register and failing to file disclosure reports for his city lobbying activities from the third quarter of 2017 through the fourth quarter of 2018. The Charter Section 706C3 establishes the penalty formula for administrative actions taken by the Ethics Commission. The maximum penalty is the greater of $5,000 per violation, or 3 times the amount that was improperly reported, spent, or received. Based on the stipulated facts and the counts in this matter, the maximum penalty for Pacific Crest Consulting is up to $45,000. That's 9 counts, times $5,000. The maximum penalty for Chris Parker is up to $45,000, 9 counts at $5,000. And the maximum penalty for John Parker is up to $40,000. That would be 8 counts down, times $5,000. In mitigation, Pacific Crest, Chris Parker, and John Parker cooperated in this investigation, saved Ethics Commission resources by entering into the stipulated settlement prior to the preparation of a probable cause report. They have filed all required disclosure reports, have no prior enforcement history with the Ethics Commission, and there is no evidence of a deliberate violation or intent to conceal or deceive. In aggravation, the respondents did not consult with the Ethics Commission staff about how to comply with the law, and the violations are serious. Based on the facts and circumstances, staff recommends resolving this matter by imposing a penalty of $22,500 against Pacific Crest, $22,500 against Chris Parker, and a penalty of $20,000 against John Parker. The recommended penalty is intended to promote the equitable treatment of respondents, encourage the early resolution of the violations, and reflect the serious nature of the violations.
Thank you, Mr. Platel. Do any commissioners have any questions?
I don't really have too many questions about this individual one, but I noticed on our right here in front of us, we have a new informational, I guess, handout, which is trying to explain better, perhaps, how land use professionals are required to register as lobbyists. Do you feel that we now have enough information out there about the requirements of registering for lobbyists?
It's my understanding that the document you had in your hand is right now we are trying to arrange with the city departments to have them posted either on their website or in their offices. But education is ongoing, and education in any field can always be better. And I'm sure over the coming months we'll strive to be even better at educating. But right now we are trying to get that out to our department heads and hopefully on our website so that it'll be maybe easier for people who are lobbying to understand what the rules are.
I think that's it's a great handout, I think.
Yeah,
so.
Thank you.
And I think you've struck a balance here between the maximum penalty and the cooperation and a recognition to the community that there is a value to coming forward as quickly as possible, cooperating, and then filing all of the disclosure reports.
Yeah, the Parkers, Chris and John Parker, were very cooperative and professional in dealing with this matter with us.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions or comments from any other commissioners?
Thank you, Mr. Platel. Can you just share a little bit about the counts at issue, to describe a little bit of what was occurring?
There are some groups that should be filing and disclosures and reports for lobbying city officials. Some believe there are expediters and they don't have to do this, do the reporting. But a close reading of the rules require, if they meet certain standards, that they should and must file registration and disclosure reports. Not all have been doing that over the past. This is not really the first case we've had like this. This is not a case of first impression. 2017, there was a case called Crest. Same fact pattern. So this is not new. This has been going on. And we're trying to, once again, we'll try to educate the people out there who are lobbying city officials and don't know or don't believe they should have to. But it's an ongoing thing. It's not new, but we are moving forward, and hopefully soon we'll have everyone in compliance. That's what we want. We don't really want to have to file penalties against. We want everyone to file on their own and comply with the rules and regulations. And this is one way that word will get out that if you do not, you're subject to these penalties. So what we really want is compliance in the long run, and that's what we're striving for with education and then have to through enforcement.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this new handout, this is also available on the website, is that correct?
If it's not up yet, it will be soon.
It is available.
It's up. Thank you.
Mr. Pritchell, you mentioned the word expediters as some people, I guess, believe this is a carve-out. Is that an official term that we recognize?
No, but it's a trade term. And hopefully, going forward, expediters who are lobbying city officials will understand that they have to file registration and disclosure reports. And that's what we're striving to do. We want them to comply. And hopefully we can do it by education, and if we have to, we'll do it through enforcement proceedings.
Thank you.
In the larger lobbying community, we've heard a great deal of concern that some of the people who have filled out the forms that are so clearly part of our agenda today have been concerned that there are too many unregistered people out there. Is at your sense that there is indeed a need for this kind of enforcement on the unregistered?
We have received complaints about a number of organizations that should be complying with the ordinances and they are not. And we get those from lobbyists who are concerned that we are complying and others are not.
what do you do when you get those complaints?
We investigate. We contact the firm or the organization. We ask for their records. We go over the records. In this case, the Pacific Crest was just very easy to deal with. And once they understood that they were not in compliance, they immediately complied and entered into the stipulation. So when we get a complaint, we move on it, and that's our function. So the more complaints we get, the more we will continue to investigate these groups.
Okay. Thank you. Well, any further questions?
No questions. I move to approve this.
We have a comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Platel. I don't think we have any further questions for you and for the investigator. Thank you.
Thank you.
We do have one public comment, and after that, I will entertain a motion. Mr. Hertz.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission and staff. Bradley Hertz of the Sutton Law Firm, not here on behalf of any particular client, here on behalf of our firm. We do not represent Pacific Crest, but we do represent others who either have been or are the subject of investigations. I won't go into any of those details, but I do very much like what I'm hearing about education over enforcement. There's certainly a need and a time and a place for enforcement, but we believe, first and foremost, education is the way you get compliance. And we understand in the permit expediter context, there are a lot of people who've been interacting with the city for years, filing forms, going over checklists, interacting with lower and mid-level staff, and they've never been told in writing or verbally, you might be a lobbyist. You should go to the City Ethics Commission website. You should make sure that you've registered if you've met certain thresholds. So we're getting too many calls, frankly, from people who were unaware, who said, I'm not meeting with the mayor and council members. I'm not trying to change the law. I'm trying to comply with the law by helping someone expand their restaurant or work on a single family dwelling. And so we are glad to see that there's a new form. We think there needs to be really a much more aggressive and positive interaction with Department of Building and Safety, Department of Planning, that documents need to be included so that it's really plain and simple to all those who are interacting with and advocating for legislative or administrative action will know that one of the very important things they need to consider is whether they are a lobbyist. So we think that while we don't know the specifics of the number four item with Pacific Crest, we think while this enforcement is going on that it should actually be stayed pending more education and more effort to make it crystal clear to people that even though you don't think of yourself as a lobbyist, you're not trying to change the law, you're not waiting in the lobby outside of the city council meetings, because you're interacting with city officials and there are discretionary acts that you're trying to affect, even in kind of the most administrative way, that you very well may be a lobbyist. We sent a letter October 1st to Executive Director Holt and Deputy Director Tristan, and it had many attachments, which we didn't include, but the letter itself is 5 pages, and I've asked the staff to hand that out today. And it basically has some very simple ideas for improving enforcement. One is, you'll see on page 2 if you have the letter, a kind of bold statement, one or two sentences, agents and representatives may be subject to City of Los Angeles lobbying registration and reporting requirements. Failure to comply may result in significant fines, with a reference to the Municipal Code section and the Ethics Commission's website. Again, we're so surprised when people call and just say, no, we're not surprised anymore. They say, I can't believe I got a letter from the Ethics Commission. I do everything to comply with the law, and I guess I'm a lobbyist, but no one ever told me. Another thing to note is that there already is robust disclosure for permit expediters. So when they become a representative for an applicant, their name is all over documents. They're the ones who are interacting with the city. So they're not these shadow lobbyists who we might otherwise be concerned about, who are the traditional lobbyists who are unknown. These are folks who have filed many forms. You can Google them, and you'll see copies of letters and copies of applications, and they just never knew that they fit into the category of a lobbyist because it just didn't compute. Now it is starting to, and we think the way people should learn is not by a call or a letter or a subpoena from enforcement, but instead because it's right there in the educational function. And we have some other suggestions in the letter that there are a whole host of checklists and forms that need to be filled out when you're, of course, applying for a permit. And we think that on all of those forms there should be this kind of disclaimer that says you might be a lobbyist. In addition, we like the fact that there's now a new fact sheet, because previously, while there was a very brief reference to, you know, it's not only the traditional lobbyists, it's architects and lawyers and others who might be lobbyists, there hadn't been that level of disclosure. And finally, speaker cards and meeting agendas have not mentioned you might be a lobbyist. It says if you're being paid to be here, write that down. But again, and I mentioned in Beverly Hills City Hall, when you walk in, there's a huge sign, probably 6 feet by 4 feet, that says, you know, if you're contacting city officials, you may be a lobbyist. Research it. File what you need to file. And then finally, we think there needs to be more and better communication coming out of the city departments, planning, building and safety, Department of Neighborhood Empowerment, so that it's not a surprise. It's not a guessing game. We think that education really needs to be first and foremost. And then when people do not file and become subject to enforcement, they'll have no excuse that, well, I didn't know, because then you'll say, well, it was listed 10 different times. So, again, enforcement has a place. If we had our druthers, this enforcement matter would be put on hold until more robust education could be engaged in, and we're happy to continue working with the commission in that regard.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
With that, are there any more questions or comments? Just to clarify, as far as the proposed stipulation, it would be a fine of the recommended fine of $22,500 to Pacific Crest, $22,500 to Chris Parker, and $20,000 to John Parker. Just to clarify that, is there any discussions or motion?
A motion. I move to approve the proposed settlement.
For all three.
Before all three, yes.
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Now on to action item 5, stipulation in matter of 1181 North Hillcrest Road.
Richard Platel for the LA Ethics Commission, Director of Enforcement. And seated with me is Eric Asubio, an investigator in our office. The stipulation before you for your consideration involves 1181 North Hillcrest Road, LLC. The president owner of the Hillcrest LLC is Mr. Bruce Mikowski. Hillcrest LLC is represented by attorney Ronald Richard. Respondent and counsel are not present today. Hillcrest LLC stipulated to 10 counts in violation of City Charter Section 470K, assumed named contributions, and one count in violation of Charter Section 470C3, excess contribution. And Mr. Mikowski personally contributed $700 to the Pellico for City Council 2015 Campaign Committee in April 2014. A short time later, he asked his executive assistant to request $700 contributions from 10 employees and business associates of Hillcrest and to tell them they would be reimbursed. The executive assistant conveyed his request, and 10 persons associated with Hillcrest provided $700 checks to the Pellico campaign, and shortly thereafter, Hillcrest LLC funds were used to reimburse the 10 contributors. Charter Section 706C3 establishes the penalty formula for administrative actions taken by the Ethics Commission. The maximum penalty is the greater of $5,000 per violation, or three times the amount that was improperly reported, spent, or received. Based on the stipulated facts and counts in this matter, the maximum penalty is $71,000. That's counts 1 through 10 at $5,000 for $50,000, and count 11, the excess contribution, is $7,000 times 3 is $21,000 for a total of $71,000. In mitigation, Hillcrest cooperated in the investigation and saved Ethics Commission resources by entering into a stipulation before an administrative hearing was scheduled, and Hillcrest has no prior enforcement action. In aggravation, the reimbursement of campaign contributions is an extremely serious matter that involves deliberate action and conceals the true identity of the contributor. In addition, Hillcrest LLC did not consult with Ethics Commission staff about how to comply with the law. Based on the facts and circumstances, staff recommends resolving this case by imposing a penalty of $71,000. The recommended penalty is intended to promote the equitable treatment of respondents, encourage the early resolution of the violations, and reflect the serious nature of the violations.
Thank you. I must say, this is a textbook case of money laundering, and I appreciate all of your efforts. I have a couple of questions, and then I'll open it up to the other commissioners. Was Ms. Pellico contacted, and did she cooperate in the investigation?
We conducted many, many interviews. Almost everyone we interviewed cooperated. I'm not sure how much more I can say in terms of, Ms. Pellico cooperated.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments from any of the commissioners?
Well, it is a textbook case, and I cannot understand how these cases still keep happening, and I think it was appropriate that even with their cooperation, that there was no change in the amount of the penalty.
Thank you. And can you just please, for the record, elucidate why you feel that the maximum penalty is appropriate in this case?
Assumed name contributions is a very serious offense. To me, it's one of our most serious offenses. And unless there is a overriding reason not to, I would probably recommend 100% maximum penalty on all those cases. I think a message has to be sent that this kind of conduct has to stop, and I think one of the ways to do that is to enforce with a maximum penalty.
Thank you. Do any of the other commissioners have any questions or comments?
You know, both this meeting, we've had two instances, and last meeting, another serious instance, where we've had these cases apparently have come to us through whistleblowers, which is certainly in the news right now. And I just want to say, go, City of Los Angeles whistleblowers. Thank you for your service. And keep them coming.
Thank you. Thank you. We do have a comment from Mr. Kwan.
Morning. I think this should be sent back. I appreciate all of the questions you had. One question that I think begs an answer is why we're fining the company and not the individual responsible. This is a situation where we don't have any room for doubt. If there was some question as to who exactly directed what, I could understand why we might hold the company accountable, but we have facts that elucidate that the individual who is the executive directed the staff to take specific actions, and they were reimbursed. I think that's we're finding the conduit instead of the bad actor. And if we're wondering why we have to keep on addressing these situations, maybe we should look at that. The former Ethics Commission Enforcement Director said as much. He said, companies don't, and this was about this specific situation, companies don't launder money, political contributions, people do. Ethics shouldn't muddle culpability by letting powerful folks off the hook. In the press, the attorney for this individual emphasized that the fine was on the company and not on his client. I think that should tell you something. that the lawyer for this individual is bragging that the company is being held responsible and not the individual. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kwan.
Can I ask if our staff could address that issue, please?
Well, this is not, once again, a case of first impression where an LLC has been found culpable of violating assumed name contributions. I have names of three other cases since 2013 where LLCs were found culpable of assumed named contributions. So it's not, it's not a case of first impression. It's standard when LLCs have violated the rules. The contributions were reimbursed from LLC funds. The contributors who were solicited to contribute all had a relationship in one way or another with the LLC. Mr. Mikowski made a donation on his own behalf from his own private funds, not from the LLC funds. Mr. Mikowski did not sign the checks on the reimbursements. The LLC under California law is an individual, and it is not anything out of the ordinary for an LLC to be found culpable on these counts. So we handle this case no differently than any other case.
Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? Just to clarify, Mr. Platel and the enforcement arm are suggesting the maximum fine of $71,000 for the LLC, Hillcrest LLC, and there has been a proposed stipulation on that matter. Is there a motion?
I just have one question. Yes. Following up on Arcelus, Commissioner Campos's motion. So individuals themselves in this situation who are actively involved, we would not pursue them by tradition or by law or facts, or I'm not quite following
the
logic.
You mean the contributors?
Yes.
I've looked over almost all the stipulated settlements since about 2011, and I can't recall, and I'm trying to recall, but I can't recall one case where a contributor was held culpable of violating those rules.
So it's by tradition then?
Well, I don't want to say tradition, but I just, it has not, from my knowledge, it has not occurred. Once again, I'm trying to remember from the past 8 years from the STIPs I reviewed, but I can't recall one being, I don't want to say there are, I guess we can call them a conduit of some sort. We investigated this case thoroughly, conducted many interviews of everyone involved, and got cooperation once again from almost everyone. So it was the decision to go with the LLC based on the evidence before us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And just to continue that, the actual contributor, because we do talk about Mikowski stating that Pellico asked him to contribute to mm-hmm. her campaign. So Mikowski did not contribute is what we're saying, but the LLC did.
Mr. Mikowski sent a $700 personal check. It was not issued on LLC okay. accounts.
And then
shortly thereafter, he asked his executive assistant to find 10 people.
So it was the LLC that actually gave the money to the individuals who had contributed.
Who reimbursed the individuals. The LLCs came, the reimbursement funds came from LLC accounts.
I think the comments made are good comments, and prior history about the need to assure that the right people are being right entity or people are being held accountable. Exactly. I think that this is potentially, obviously, a technical way of avoiding any individual responsibility if the funds are used from an LLC. I think technically this was under the circumstances before we have dealt with this issue more specifically. I think this is probably the right thing to have done. I do think the comments that have been made by the public here are worth considering it with more depth, because it does really appear as a potential way of skirting the individual responsibility. But under the circumstances, with the history that you've had here, I think we should go ahead with this stipulation, and I think it's something that we should look into further.
Agreed. I think, sorry, Chair, okay. But the investigation is perfect, and obviously if we have a history of proceeding in this way, but I think Mr. Kwan brings up a really interesting sort of loophole. And if there's a solution, great, but the work has been done here, and you guys are to be congratulated for that.
Ms. Campos, Commissioner Campos had.
Thank you. But just following that thread, I think beyond this matter, there's an interest among many, including the public, to better understand in what situations would an individual be liable. I suppose it's a piercing of the corporate veil research project connected to these issues. And there's just, while there may not be recent precedent, I think there's just an interest in a better understanding what those scenarios might be and what authority or purview we would have to bring some of that recourse if when necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, is there a motion to approve the stipulation?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Platel.
Thank you, Mr.
Moving on to action item number 6. Mr. Joseph, you move quick.
Good morning. For item number 6, what we have is a recusal review for a Mr. Mel Levine. He is the president of the Board of Water and Power Commissioners. Mr. Levine has served on that board since September of 2013, and his current term will expire in June of 2024. He has been the subject of 5 previous recusal reviews, all of those related to his interests in the law firm of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, who occasionally represents third parties in litigation against the city. In this particular instance, Mr. Levine recused himself from 18 matters during the review period. All of those were related to his interest in the law firm. Each one of those was related to closed session discussion of litigation where no action was taken at any of those meetings. As with the previous reviews, we have determined that his recusals were not significant in terms of number or impact on the board's activity. And as a result, we recommend finding that no divestment be required and adopting the resolution in Attachment D for that purpose. And I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
I do want to make a comment, and this is, again, this is Congressman Levine's, I think, 6th matter before us, and I find that just a little bit troubling. I understand that the what you've recommended and has been, I'm losing my train of thought, but they're insignificant, but the fact that this is the 5th or 6th inquiry, I think that is significant.
That's absolutely understandable. One note I would make is that the bulk of these recent reviews have actually been related to a single issue, a case involving a billing issue with PwC and the city. That case was actually recently dismissed. It is ongoing in terms of a dispute over the attorney's fees, I believe. The discussion of that that's gone on that Mr. Levine has recused himself from in the past has frequently resulted in no action being taken, as I mentioned, just closed session discussion. That has accounted for a significant number of these, and the fact that that is a single issue that has been going on for quite a while, and in this case it actually represents more than half of the recusals during this review period, is part of what led us to believe that these recusals are not significant in terms of their overall impact on his participation on the board.
Okay. Thank you.
And one of the major reasons for our continuing to have this before us and prove it on the approvals is some sort of percentage of what the work is that he does,
yes,
versus
that's
the
correct.
Other. And just remind us again what how you determined that it was insignificant in terms of the percentages.
We actually go through and count up all of the individual items that the board acts on during each review period, and then we count, obviously, the number of recusals that are made, and we weigh that as a percentage, which we include in the report. I believe in this particular case, Mr. Levine participated in more than 96% of the items before the board. So while 18 does sound like a lot, they have a lot of work to do.
Thank you. Any further questions from anyone? Is there a motion to approve attachment D?
I move to approve attachment D.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Moving on to action item 7, Mr. Joseph.
Okay, action item number 7 is an updated conflict of interest code for the City Ethics Commission. These updates are to reflect two new positions that were added to the Ethics Commission for the fiscal budget for the upcoming year. Specifically, they are a project assistant and a commission hearing examiner. Those have been added to the list of designated positions, which you can find on the first page of attachment A. And by adding these new positions, the updates to the code also includes identifying these designated positions by their citywide job class specifications. And that is a change from the current practice of identifying them by their internal working titles. And that has a couple of benefits. One is that it creates more uniformity across city departments. That allows like positions to be placed in like categories and require like disclosures so that things are a little more uniform across the different departments. Another benefit is that it allows us to change internal working titles without having to actually amend our conflict of interest code, so it makes things a little bit easier in that respect as well. And all of the procedural requirements for this change have been satisfied, so what we'd like to do this morning is recommend that you adopt the updated conflict of interest code in attachment A. If you approve that, it will be transmitted to City Council, and if approved by Council, it becomes effective immediately. So I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I just want to commend, again, the ethics staff and Mr. Joseph. I did review all of it, and it is quite lengthy and quite detailed. And it just took me a couple of hours just to get through this. So I know that you spend many more going over this and cross-checking. So I really want to commend Mr. Joseph and the ethics staff.
Well, I will say I'm standing in today, so that was our ethics team that did all the work on that. So thank
you.
Well,
again, to you and the entire team. With that, are there any questions or comments? Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kwan.
So recent events have led me to get a little bit of interest in the founding of the Ethics Commission and the Conflict of Interest Code and a little history talk. I really grateful that we have an Ethics Commission, commissioners. We've made a lot of progress in 30 years as far as reform. We're in a better place in that way. But with our council members, with City Hall, unfortunately, we're actually way worse off than we were 30 years ago. And I didn't realize that until I looked into the city archives and paid attention to what happened in 1989. It's funny because the LA Times at the time was giving council a lot of smack like a lot of shit for not doing enough to rein in Tom Bradley and investigate him. But they actually had investigations in city council into Tom Bradley, something we wouldn't see now. We look at our current situation. The Ethics Commission submitted a number of major reforms in February. Council has had exactly two meetings in the 9 months since, and it looks as though significant portions of what we were hoping to see in those reforms are being quietly chopped off to the side. In 1989, Mayor Bradley appointed a citizen-led commission, the Cohen Commission. They held a number of hearings throughout the city. They compiled a report in November. Long, a lot longer than what you sent council, a whole lot more complex, a whole lot more new territory. They got this in mid-November. Within a month, they had three meetings, more than we've seen in 9 months here. They went into their winter recess. They came back. They had three more meetings in January. And then by February, they were putting this thing on the ballot. They were able to move this onto the ballot in the amount of time it took our city attorney to send over some ordinances and leave one out. So I just highlight that to show what kind of situation we're in. In the past, our council members were digging in. They were engaged. And I just think that your work is really important. I appreciate you being on top of things, asking good questions, because one of the worst things we can do in America is fall victim to our affinity for tradition. A lot of times that can prevent us from reimagining what we could do differently, what we can do better. I think, you know, I know the Ethics Commission has a copy of this somewhere. It's something worth looking at to see what they recommended, what didn't make it, as well as what they were trying to do. Because there's a lot as far as the philosophy of what this commission is supposed to be about that's contained in there. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Kwan. And with that, is there any further comment or discussion on item number 7? At this point, I will entertain a motion to approve the updated conflict of interest policy.
I move to approve the proposed conflict of interest code in attachment A.
Thank you.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Motion carries. Thank you. And our last action item of the day, professional services agreement. Ms. Holt.
Good morning. I think I get the easy lifting this morning on this with this item. This is an item regarding a professional services agreement with TLC Interpreting and Translation Services, Inc., that would give us access to those kinds of services through the course of our work through July of 2020, and the contract could be extended for up to 2 years in 1 year increments. If the contract meets with your approval, you may adopt the resolution in attachment A, which would approve the contract and authorize me to execute it. And I'm happy to answer questions.
Commissioners?
I would like to make a motion to approve.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So that
Thank you.
Ends our action
Make
item.
Make it even easier.
Oh, I do. I got it. Thank you. While you have the floor, Ms. Holt, can you just briefly give us a little update and your executive director's report?
Absolutely. What I'm most excited about is to introduce to you a new auditor who has joined our team, Stephen Desowitz, who I believe is in the back. Mr. Desowitz has been a valuable part of our staff actually on an as-needed basis for a number of years, so it's a pleasure to be able to add him to our permanent staff, and he is already hitting the ground running on learning our audit processes.
Great.
The staff has been working hard. The numbers in terms of advice and disclosure are pretty significant for the first three quarters of the year. The better part of 18,000 contacts regarding helping people to comply with the laws. Over 17,000 filings that we've processed, and we've personally or individually trained over 1,000 individuals. The other piece of significance is the ongoing elections, and we will have staff on location with the city clerk's office over at Piper Tech during the first week of November for candidate filing week, so that to make things as easy as possible for candidates who have to file forms with both the city clerk's office and our office.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Joseph, if you could just give us a report on policy and legislation update. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. So to give you a brief rundown since the last meeting, the matching funds item that was alluded to earlier became effective on September 24th. The updates to the ticket policy that were approved by this body at the prior meeting have been approved by City Council and transmitted to the mayor for his signature. The developer contribution and behested payment proposals, those draft ordinances were transmitted in September by the city attorney's office. That is three ordinances, one reflecting our proposals, the second reflecting the proposals from Councilmember Rue, and the third specifically addressing the behested payments. And those ordinances can be found in attachments B, C, and D, respectively, of the policy update. And we are currently awaiting those being scheduled in the Rules Committee. And the Ethics Commission's Conflict of Interest Code, which you just approved, will be transmitted shortly after this meeting.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, one final.
I have a couple of questions.
Oh, sure. Sorry.
Has staff taken the ordinances and done its traditional work with the our proposal and the ordinance, and to show any differences or any times that it's together?
Yes, we have. We have gone through and compared each of the three to sort of address those kind of side by side, what some of the differences are. There are some changes that have been made throughout the process. We could talk a little bit more about them now, or we could also write you a sort of a short report, summarize them, and send them over that way.
I think we're hopeful that there will be some hearings very, very soon. So perhaps you could just mention a couple of them now, and yes, I think we would like to have those issues before us so that we can participate in the ongoing ordinances.
Yeah, and I know specifically at least one. The city attorney did not recommend the individual ban because that needs to be amended by an amendment of the city charter. That's correct.
Yes, that's correct. So the non-individual ban that was in the Ethics Commission's proposal was removed because it would require a change to the charter, which could be something that could be placed on the ballot, for example. So that was one of the major changes. When this eventually is scheduled for the Rules Committee, there will be a full discussion of what the proposals were, how they differ, specifically, I think, how the Ethics Commission's proposal differs from the proposal in Attachment C, and whether or not the decision to move forward with the behested ordinance is going to be made. I think that discussion, when it's ultimately scheduled for the Rules Committee, will be fairly lengthy. As of now, we have not heard when that might be. It's possible that it will happen by the end of the year, but we are going to continue to reach out to City Council staff to get a better idea of when that might happen, and we will certainly let you know as soon as we have that information.
I would add that a couple of other significant differences between what was recommended and the ordinance that is now with rules is with regard to fundraising. The recommendation was to prohibit fundraising for on a broader scale, just sort of you can't fundraise for lobbyists and developers, prohibited developers, and that was modified in the ordinance that the Rules Committee has so that it's now a prohibition against fundraising among prohibited developers and property owners. So it's a very limited world of people who could not be toward whom fundraising efforts could not be made. So it's a much more limited version of the prohibition on fundraising. Another significant difference is that the recommendation was to prohibit contributions to any committee controlled by a city candidate or a city official, and that was modified to just city committees. So there are some limitations in terms of what you recommended versus what the city council is now proposing. There's also another ordinance, a completely different ordinance, that more that reflects Councilmember Rue's motion rather than your recommendations, and that is different too. The most significant difference that I am thinking of now is the way that he defines the developers, and that ordinance is based on specific types of permits or activities conducted at the planning department rather than a person's relationship to a particular discretionary type of decision that the planning department or an elected official might be required to make. And then the third ordinance is the behested ordinance, which pretty much looks exactly the way you recommended it should.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments for Mr. Tyler or Ms. Hutt?
And
Holt?
If you are interested in the categorization, as Heather mentioned, as far as the difference between the two ordinances, as I mentioned, those are both in the attachments. You can see in Councilmember Rue's ordinance the laundry list of different categories at the planning department that they sort of use to define developers, and you can see how that differs from the Ethics Commission's recommendations, but that is in the attachment to the policy update.
Thank you.
Very good. To thank you for doing that work and then keeping us advised and perhaps see what we can do about assuring that this really does go forward before the end of the year.
Thank you. Yeah. And now to close the meeting out, Mr. Kwan, did you wish to make any further comments?
Yeah.
General public comments. Thank you.
Save the fun one for last. I forgot to mention earlier when I was looking back in the archives, the most striking thing I saw was one council member popping up. And they popped up a lot in the council file system, but looking in the archives, you can see a whole lot more as far as the motions that were entertained by council members from December to February. And Nate Holden was fiercely against ethics reform in the late 80s, early 90s, routinely. And we should remember who his chief of staff was. Our current council president, Herb Wesson, been fighting against reform for 30 plus years. There's a reason you should be very skeptical of everyone you're interacting with here. You should wonder why there's only four of you. We're approaching a year at which there was a vacancy. The charter provides that within 30 days we're supposed to have somebody appointed for good reason, probably to insulate it from political considerations, like somebody being on the campaign trail, like somebody jockeying for a leadership position. That's not something that should be dangled out there. So to continue, as far as why we should be very cynical about this city hall, in addition to the minor things around the edges, which we were kind of expecting from the city attorney as far as modifications, we didn't get an ordinance back on the non-individual ban. I would have assumed that we would either get implementing ordinances or something about moving it forward with a charter. The city council has until October 30th to initiate that process with a resolution requesting the city attorney to draft something. That hasn't happened. They don't want that to move forward. And there's a reason for that. As we've discussed before, 80% of contributions in the city of LA come from individuals, the other 20% coming from non-individuals. Well, looked into our recent data for all of our current elected officials, 69% of their money comes from individuals, far less. When you look at their office holder accounts, 53% is the average. They're afraid of letting that money go free. They would rather have it in their control. And in particular, they would rather have it in their control as they are approaching the 2020 cycle or the 2022 cycle, when we've got a city attorney, at least three, four council members interested in running for mayor. So this stuff isn't going to apply there. And for the developer ban, we have to also wonder, what is it going to take funding-wise, infrastructure-wise, to get this up in March. It doesn't sound like that's possible, even if council passed it today and gave the money. So we need to be very cognizant of the timing and the intention of some to delay the actual effect of these things. I'm even more frustrated because the motion that was sent to the city attorney gave him a whole lot of leeway to make technical corrections, legal corrections, modifications, just as we were talking about the fundraising and bundling restrictions. What did he do? He said, okay, this isn't good. Here's something that works. I would have assumed that we would have gotten something like that on the non-individual ban. We didn't get that. That was a political decision, not a legal decision. And I think even if we look at the actual question of, does a non-individual ban need to go on the ballot? The city attorney has lost twice this year with Commissioner Oberstein's case and with Eric Previn. He filed a lawsuit over the Brown Act. And the court said, no, look, you're wrong. The city attorney has it wrong, and the legislative history says you're wrong. Let's look back 1990 when we actually had this language regarding non-individuals coming into place. This was a very small side issue. If you look at the voter information pamphlet, the arguments in favor and against make mention to contribution limits, but don't get into this specifically. The CLA discusses it. The charter currently limits the amount of campaign contributions from any single source. This amendment would set limits on total campaign contributions a candidate could receive from such organizations as businesses and labor unions, but there would be no such total limit on contributions from individuals. Our city attorney would have us believe that when the voters of LA rose up in 1990 and set monumental campaign finance restrictions in place, they were actually, unbeknownst to us, embedding corporate personhood in our charter. That's bizarre. That's bizarre because, if anything, what's described is the proposition that corporations, non-individuals, are distinctly different from human beings. Furthermore, let's look at 2011, the second time we had a Measure H. There was a little bit of language tucked in there. And this was, I wonder, how could we get a developer ban that doesn't need a charter amendment, but this needs a charter amendment? The only reason the developer ban arguably doesn't need a charter amendment is because of language added in 2011. In addition to the provisions of the charter, the city may adopt additional restrictions by ordinance. The city may adopt additional restrictions by ordinance. This is an additional restriction. So we should be wondering what kind of legal basis this is being posed on. It's all kind of moot because council doesn't want to touch that. But we could do a whole lot more as far as banning corporations and LLCs, doing something like the federal government does, but council doesn't want to move towards that. I'm going to try to see what we can do, but it's insane to think that in the midst of multiple FBI investigations, you talk about whistleblowers. This has touched every single one of our 18 elected officials as far as their institutions. There's a whistleblower saying that the city controller's office intimidated somebody, and their house was broken into the same day they met with LADWP. So the PricewaterhouseCooper lawsuit, it might be settled, but it's not done. It's still being looked into. It's insane to think that as our elected officials talk about restoring trust, restoring faith in city government, that they're pulling shit like this. It's insulting to all of us. It's insulting to the voters who are losing faith in our ability to combat homelessness, build affordable housing, confront all of the crises we face. I'll end on a nicer note. I say all this to hopefully offer some reason to I take these things with some invigoration. It makes me want to dig in a little deeper because it is a messy-ass process, but, hey, we got some major reforms done this year. I looked back, and there was a council file introduced by Councilmember Bill Rosendahl and Jose Huizar like 8 years ago, and it sought to lower the qualification threshold for our matching funds program. And even in 1990, I found a motion from back then seeking to lower the qualifying threshold for the matching funds program because they felt as though it offered an unfair advantage to incumbents. So it may take a long-ass time, 30 years, but we're still doing some stuff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kwan. And with that, it is 10:45, and is there a motion to adjourn?
I do have a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. No opposition. Thank you, everyone. I'll call you the regulator.